Hello, I'm Dr. Lou Condor, technical communicator, writer, editor, and adjunct lecturer at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Welcome to C Cubed, Clear, Concise Communication. This is the podcast for the information design course. In this class, we discuss document design, layout, graphics, and usability in technical documentation. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Topography and Navigation. I'm going to talk a little bit about these two topics. They're quite important in technical communication and actually in all forms of communication, especially since we do a lot of web work today. According to Kimball and Hawkins, careful typographic design creates clear structure, distinguishes between different kinds of text design objects, and implies a positive ethos. So the first thing, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about is the history, because I think that's very important in what's going on with typography. Now, let's look at the history. Throughout a lot of mankind's history, people have handwritten material, like mainly things like the Bible. And that's kind of what inspired Gutenberg to take and create the printing press in 1440. So really modern type ideology starts in 1440. Then we can jump forward to 1722 and William Carson. He invented Carlson typeface. You probably have actually seen that. And that is how old it really is. It starts to speed up after that point. And we can look at 1757, Baskerville type was invented. Then in 1784, Furman Dido, I hope I'm saying his name right, created the modern typeface. And in 1816, sans serif was created by William Carlson IV, which is like the great grandson. So you start seeing that there's a speed up in the time frame. And then 1817, slab serif was invented and so on like that. So then it becomes sped up as to how typeface is being used and how it's being created and rules. So typeface has been around a long time, and it's gone through quite a bit of change. Of course, modern type rules and layout come from centuries of use and change with technology. To make a long story short, it comes from print, and we get navigation from print as well. And that's how where we're at on the modern page. Check out the history of typography I'm posting in the classroom. It's a graphic, and it will give you a little more clarity as to see how that acceleration happened with text. Now, I'm going to go back to the lecture a little bit. How shapes affect reading? Now, we'll look at the different shapes. It's broken down. Now we're going to go back to the lecture. How shapes affect reading? You can see I have a Helvetica and a sans serif. And you can see that type has measurements. And the way it is laid out, you have cap heights. There's a standardization, in other words, to everything out there. Now, serif means small feet, and they're the little marks on the bottom of the vertical stroke of the type, like Times New Roman is an example, and you'll see these little tiny hooks here and there at the very, what they call the feet of the text. Now, sans serif means without, so it's without these little feet. Helvetica is an example. You could see a good example of these two side by side in the presentation I'll post in the classroom. Now, we look at typography from three perspectives. One, perception, the visual process of identifying the meaning, the shapes, concepts, things like that. What is it implying? The culture, historical printing developments, as we talked about, that affect typography and is influenced by former handwritten type, technology, and usability. One of the big inventions of the printing press was they wanted to put out more Bibles, and that was what people were reading at the time. If they had books, books were really expensive, you know, because they were normally just handwritten. And so in order to get those out to the masses, the printing press really helped. It started to grind down to, oh, we can print faster, and the presses became automated, and now we have usability, and, you know, is it easy to read? And so it's almost become invisible, which is sort of a really neat thing going on. Finally, we have rhetoric. This can have really important effects on the user of the document. It conveying structural and rhetorical meta information. way that looks like is if you bold something, that has a different meaning than if it's not bolded. It's bringing you right in to that word. Why is this word bolded? Well, it might be a part of an instruction. It might be what you click. It could be anything, but there's a reason for it. And how do the sections of your document fit together? And that's something to think about as you continue on with creating documents. Now, there's some pretty standardized type usages. There's 6-point, which is dating a source, and those are usually the little tiny bottom of the page things. There's 8-point, which are footnotes. Like dating a source might say, you know, something very particular, but footnotes are more in depth. And so you'll kind of see the difference. Honestly, I don't know many people that use 6-point. It's very, very small. It's almost impossible to read. And it's almost more like a legal size than anything else. These are just standard ways of using text size. So 10-point is for figure captions. 12-point is your main body text. That's true of documents and mainly true in most websites. However, 11-point is also popular, and some fonts, if they are wider, thicker, and slightly taller, will use 11. So 11 and 12, slightly interchangeable in modern technology. And then you have 14-point, which is headings. Although even I do this, sometimes the headings are larger. It just depends on the body text, what the document layout is, and how it's happening. So let's talk a little bit about page design elements and visuals. Now, all elements on a web page work together to provide a positive user experience. That's what we want as a tech writer. We want a positive user experience because we want these people to be able to use the document the way they need to, skim and scan it, get the information they need, and then be able to do the task or whatever is next. So we want to make sure that this happens for them. This is true in marketing as well. If you ever write for marketing, you'll know you want people to get it. You want them, you know, sometimes if you ever see a failed ad, you'll see people didn't get it. That's a failed ad because you really want to impress the reader, the information you're trying to give them. Avoid confusing or difficult to read type elements, visuals, and page design. There's a new trend in the ever scrolling page. I don't really see the need. For me, all the usability testing I've done, users eventually stop scrolling. So unless you have just weird disclosures at the bottom that you're trying to hide, I wouldn't do it. And then that becomes an ethics issue. So I just look at it like you're better off with clickable links that the user can go to where the data is right there or the information is right there on the page. This all leads us to navigation. Now, navigation has been around as long as the printing press. When you think about it, you have a table of contents, which tells you where everything is. You have indexes, which tell you other information. These are all creations and standardizations from print. In navigation, usability is very important, and that's why we get into other areas of this. Users need to find the info they need efficiently. Today's attention span on the web, about 3 to 5 seconds. After that, the user will leave. We must take navigation into account on usability. It's really important. Use visual and spatial cues to assist users. You want to think about the following. What is clicked, dragged, pushed? Locations of buttons, menus, titles. Where are these things on the page? Can the user access them really easily? How does the user interact with navigation? Are they having issues with finding information? This is where testing really helps. Do they need to scroll too much? Are they looking around? Is it that never-ending scrolling page? I saw one page that literally you could scroll for 5 minutes. And that is really low usability. And actually, I never hit the end of it because I gave up. So you want to make sure that doesn't happen to yours. Look at the example on the next slide. And this is the slide I have in, it's on slide 12. What navigation and visual cues are present? I took a page from Wikipedia, and you could see that there are all kinds. There's a search box at the top. Help and contents is at the very top left. Okay, so you can really, you know exactly what it is right away. You have how to find and read an article on the left and how to edit an article on the right in two columns. The two column setup helps usability in here. We're talking about grid patterns. It really, really helps because the user knows that they can find either item in their help, and they've probably done a lot of testing to make sure that they get precisely what they think their users are going to need. You can also see that things like Reader's FAQ, or FAQ, and About Page, the blue signifies a link and that people can click on it. And when they hover over it, you know, it takes and tells them that there's a link. So I want to talk about the five rules to navigation for the web. It's this comes from Miller. And I know that the source looks fairly old. It's 2010, but it's still totally relevant. This type of stuff doesn't change a whole lot. People will try to change it, but it doesn't change because conventions are there for a reason. People are used to them, or the mind and the eye wants to follow them. One, navigation should be easy to find. As I just discussed, things on a page should be easy to use. If not, your user is going to give up. And remember, you've got that 3 to 5 seconds time span before they just leave. Consistent. You want to maintain style, types, and colors throughout the document, throughout the website, throughout the help docs. Whatever you're doing, you want to have a very specific look and feel. Even the grid pattern should be fairly maintained on most pages, especially on pages for particular things. For example, tasks. Whenever somebody goes to do a task, if you're using a single column page, then that's what it should be. If you're using two columns, it should be that way throughout the entire manual or website or document. Other pages could have different grid patterns, but that is really important for the same task or the same thing that the user is going to do, that they should have a consistent pattern. Obvious section names, be clear and concise. And, you want to look at help sections. Like, for example, you can see this in the lecture. There's, I took a snapshot of the top part of the page and they have tabs. In that Wikipedia page, they have tabs for the help. You know, so you can look at history, you can look at source, you can read, you can, you know, talk, you can do a lot of things. So they highlight the tab that you're on. So the tab would be white if it's highlighted. Otherwise, it's sort of blued out, you know, and that's their convention. And they will keep that convention throughout the site. Less is more. Keep choices to a minimum. Don't have 100 different ways to click into something. It just confuses the reader. Remind the users where they are. Like in that tab on the help for Wikipedia, they actually have two different ways. It says help page and it's highlighted. And then on the top of the page for reinforcement, they have help contents. The help contents is not clickable. It's reiterating where they're at. That's it for this week. Thank you. And as one last task, I recommend you going on the web and looking at different documents to see if the navigation and the typeface work for you. Ask yourself the question, what works and what doesn't? Anyway, have a great rest of the week. That's it for this podcast. Thank you for joining me. Music for this recording was supplied by Dano Songs Royalty Free Music at www.danosongs.com. Copyright 2018.